In this episode, we ask the question, how did IWC come to be the watch brand of a fictional Formula One team in F1, the movie? We talk about the watches, we talk about the stunts. We also talk about Tom Cruise and Top Gun Maverick with some behind the scenes stories from Chris, who was there for the shoot.
John Deere, we're here.
Hello. We are back again. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to a show that was created to give you what you want. And what is that, Chris?
Well, the inside scoop and background story of Formula One, the movie, which I think is one of the most unique movie projects in recent years.
Well, by saying that, there were two episodes that didn't mention it. Were they the foreplay? Was that the lead up to this episode?
You edited me out every single time. I came in the shirt and you said, no, that doesn't work. Go and get changed.
I did. Chris actually turned up to episode one in, I'm not going to say the fire suit or the race suit, but pretty much he was dressed like he's on Team Apex.
Which channeling my inner Toto.
So this whole concept of the podcast, I'll be honest with you, I'm going to level up with you. It came about because Chris kept whispering incredible anecdotes in my ear at Watches and Wonders about the making of this movie and how cool it was. And I looked at our final cut, and I'm looking at you, Marcus Flack. I looked at our final cut of the video and said, where is all that cool stuff that we talked about?
In La Reserve.
And Marcus is like, watches. People want the watches. So much ended up on the cutting room floor, and I knew that there was more. So we created this concept, and I think so far it's been we've bitten off more than I ever thought that we could chew, because we've now covered off an episode that talked about the partnership aspect, IWC joining Formula One in 2013, and we did an episode about the watches of that halcyon era. Mm. But now we're here, Chris. We are at the Formula One. How do we refer to this?
F1 the movie.
F1 the movie, exactly. Must be mentioned in exactly that way. But we have a lot to talk about. We have watches on the table. In this episode, we are going to, Chris, you set the running, because this is your baby.
Absolutely. I mean, let's talk a little bit about this unique project, what makes it so unique and why it's really pushing the boundaries of motorsport filmmaking. And then let's talk about, you know, what happens when you start a team sponsor partnership with a virtual Formula One team embedded into the real world of Formula One. This is where it all gets a little bit messy, but hang in there. It's worth it.
Fantastic. Before we get there, I do have to ask you something. Unscripted, and I know you can take this. What sort of a driver are you, and did you drive here today?
Yes, I did drive here today. Like, I drive in most places in the world. It's one of the bits of freedom, I think, that I try to preserve in my job, because I don't like being driven, for starters. Like, not on a racetrack and not in real life. It's one of those weird things. And what sort of driver am I? Don't ask my wife, honestly.
We have this on the phone, Tanya.
There's this terrible app called Life 360, which is basically like a family tracker and driving analytics app.
Sounds like a recipe for divorce.
We came back. So my wife and I, we ran a mountain half marathon in Flims on the weekend, and we came back, and it's about 2 hours drive. And my son just looked at his Life 360 app and said, Dad, it says today, risky drive, 1 hour 59, 17 risky events. So this is what they say. But no,
what purpose could this app have apart from marital disharmony?
Apparently, you can find out where your loved ones are at any time
of
the day.
And the risk profile of who they're in a car with.
Exactly.
So it sounds to me like, let me try and unpack this. You've gotten back from a half marathon. Mm. You've been stiff in the quads.
Sort of, yeah.
Yep. Potentially.
Not just the quads, unfortunately.
I'm not going there.
No. I said, unfortunately.
Got it. Eager to get home. Perhaps, you know, was there, it doesn't tell you when you broke the speed limit, does it?
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
It does.
And no, it doesn't.
Yeah, no. But, anything that it considers, you know, I've learned braking on a racetrack. So I don't brake, you know, like you learn in driving school. When I brake like you do in a car. But anyway, I think this is territory best left to another conversation. But no, to your point of what sort of driver am I think there is... there's the quickest line drivers and there's drivers that have a lot of fun with driving. I think I would definitely put myself into that second camp. And incidentally, I actually know two people in the Mercedes world who very much drive like that. Toto is one of them and Jerome D'Ambrosio is the other one, who are very deep into the corners, quite late on the apex and quite sideways coming out of the corners, which isn't the fastest way to get around the corner, but is by far the most enjoyable. So this is the type of driving I like.
And there's a question for you, actually. Mm. What does Toto enjoy driving?
Yes. Yes, he does. Unlike Lewis.
Lewis doesn't. Have you ever been driven by Lewis anywhere?
No, I haven't been driven by Lewis, and Lewis doesn't drive a lot. You know, he's, you see him, Toto does drive, yes, and Toto likes driving.
Interesting.
Likes driving on a racetrack.
Okay.
Fast.
Well, it's wrist check time.
Yeah, absolutely. So
we got
changing gears from one team watch to another. So this is the actual Apex Formula One team watch, Pilot's Chronograph 41 stainless steel with the black and gold accents, so the Apex GP team name laser engraved on the rubber strap. And this is the official team watch of the virtual Apex GP Formula One team from F1 the movie.
Is that available publicly?
It is available. It's in stores now. We have a 43mm version, 41mm version, both of the glass case back. They've got the Apex GP logo emblazoned on the sapphire case back and that color coding of the team throughout, and is available now.
Amazing. I have.
What are you wearing?
Well, yeah, what am I wearing? Well, actually, we need to talk about what we're wearing clothes-wise. If you're listening to this podcast, you need to picture two people who have the same team shirt on, because I have a polo shirt.
Almost. Team boss, team mechanic.
Oh, God. You had to go there. It had to. Boom. Has to be a hierarchy. Yes. I'm in a really nice, slinky polo shirt that feels fantastic. It's got lots of brands on it, not just IWC. It has Expensified Tommy Hilfiger.
Shows off your biceps AMG. Very well. That's why I've gone for long sleeve. Yeah, so.
It's because you're the team principal. We both are in the same shirt.
Is that
shirt.
Mutually exclusive, is it? Principal and biceps.
Yes. You get
the
one.
Brains and the muscles.
You get one or the other, but not both. and we're wearing watches from the movie. And this is, as I established in episode one, maybe, or maybe off camera, this is my favorite watch of this year's IWC collection. The Sage, or the pistachio and gold Ingenieur's one, I made a fuss about at the time, but I've settled on this Performance
Chronograph, 41mm in 5N red gold.
Yep.
This is actually the watch that Damson Idris, who plays Joshua Pierce in the movie, who's the second driver in the lineup alongside Sonny Hayes, played by Brad Pitt, and it's the watch he wears in the movie.
I love this watch. I remember you saying to me that it's the most complex dial construction you've ever done. And you can see that. It really, on every angle, it gives you something. Damson Idris, that's interesting. I met Damson Idris on a rooftop in London.
Yeah, Battersea. Yeah.
Battersea, that's right. Yeah. And he was lovely. So we're going to get into all of these characters, but we've got to go back to basics.
Although I always remember that Battersea evening, because we were in a photo shoot with Lewis Hamilton on one side and Damson Idris on the other side. And they were chatting behind my back, basically, while pictures had been taken. And basically, they'd just come back from Silverstone, both of them. And Lewis asked Damson, so have you spun out yet? And he was like, no, I've pushed it, but I haven't spun. And he was just, you ain't pushing it hard enough. You haven't spun yet. You haven't pushed it hard enough yet.
So it's they were actually chatting.
That was literally like a typical, where I thought, again, like Hollywood and the world of racing really coming together, because those two pushing each other and egging each other on, that one wasn't driving hard enough. You know, this is such a paddock kind of conversation. And it just made me smile, because that really is Hollywood meets the world of Formula One.
That's crazy. So I would have loved to be a fly on the wall to hear those conversations, because, and we'll get to this, but what's different about this movie is that they actually drove.
Yeah.
And drove to a point of danger, would you say?
I wouldn't say point of danger, but definitely faster than any racing Formula One movie has ever been driven. And the only time that I'm aware of that the actors have actually driven the cars and had the driving training and all the rest of it to do a lot of the stunt work themselves. Mm. I don't think it's ever a case of, you know, being dangerous. It's just a case of pushing the boundaries and pushing the skills levels and the team and the material to deliver just much greater racing scenes. Because it's one of those things that you often see in racing movies, that when you really look at it from a racing perspective, it just all looks too slow. And this is something that that I hope Formula One has really done away with in terms of bringing the actors into the right speeds in the cars, doing that all at a GP track, inserted into real Formula One in front of a live audience, and just getting that feel right for Formula One.
And let's be real, there must have been, there's a willingness from the actors to go there and to put themselves, you know, this is not something simulated. This becomes, because we'll get into this, and I keep wanting to jump into the detail, but before we get into the skills that they acquired or the way they push themselves to deliver a movie that feels like a real, feels like the speed, is you were not a part of the decision to get into Formula One in 2013 necessarily.
No.
However, I imagine that you were the one that approved and potentially were very involved, if not the originator of this partnership.
Yeah.
Tell me, how did the F1 the movie come to be an IWC property?
Yeah, so it basically comes straight out of work on Top Gun Maverick, which kept me busy from 2017 onwards for at least 5 years. That what a project that was. And that really got me into that dream constellation, because my two youth time heroes were really Jerry Bruckheimer and Hans Zimmer. And when I was sort of, you know, getting into design and started my own sort of set designs, I watched, at the time, Bruckheimer and Simpson production movies over and over and over again. And there was just the first multiplex big box cinema opened close to where I grew up. And I could actually take a bus.
Let's reel off a few. I can think of some.
Yeah, for example, The Rock at the time.
Sean Connery.
Same sort of period as Con Air, Nicolas Cage, and all these movies came out. And The Rock, for me, is something I watched probably 10, 12 times in the cinema, like over and over and over again, looking at every single detail and just thinking, like, and that soundtrack all through my army years, I listened to The Rock score by Hans Zimmer, and that led me on to appreciating a lot of the Hans Zimmer music. And then in the end, I had never met Hans Zimmer up to that point, and we worked on Top Gun Maverick and obviously met Jerry. And through the production, they eventually connected us with Hans. And I spoke to his business manager over and over and over again. And then finally in Singapore, I got to meet Hans in our boutique just before the Singapore Grand Prix. And it was just amazing. I never knew. He grew up in the village like next to where I grew up. I never knew. Turned out later that an aunt of mine went to dancing school with him. But anyway, so it's a small world, and we could talk about home and stuff. And he said to me at the time, he said, I can't ever wear a mechanical watch when I'm playing, because when I'm sitting at the piano and playing time, it's too heavy on my wrist to play the piano. And that day, we looked at watches, and he fell in love with the Spitfire Big Pilot Perpetual Calendar in bronze, which is probably the heaviest watch we've made in recent years. And he fell in love with that, and he bought it. And that evening, I attended his concert in Singapore, and he came out and obviously played the iconic time. And I stood in front of the stage and the big screen there, and you could see Hans, that heavy watch on his wrist, playing time just fine, and he's never taken it off since. And now he says the opposite. He can't take it off because it unbalances his wrist. So that was that. So getting into a Joe Kosinski production with Jerry and Hans, and then as we're coming out of Top Gun Maverick, obviously having really, really started, you know, begun to really appreciate the work they put into the realism of these productions. And again, Top Gun Maverick being the first time that the actors were actually in the cockpit of the jets during the flying maneuvers, and not just the Top Gun instructor pilots in front flying the aircraft, but the actors having to operate the cameras in the back. And when Bruckheimer Productions came to us and said, look, we're working on something F1 racing inspired, and it's probably going to involve Mercedes, we're like, okay, you know, that's not much to argue about here. And it took a while for that to really get into full motion. But from the beginning, when I heard how they're going to approach F1 and that they're going to take a virtual F1 team and insert it into the real Formula One circus, it's just, yeah, it was a mind-blowing project. And of course, we're all in.
Tell me, you have told me several Top Gun anecdotes over those 5 years, and most of them, I imagine, can't be retold, because they're often, you tell me amazing stories about this 5 years. What's the furthest you can push it to tell me an incredible story about that period that maybe changed your view of actors or movies or productions? Because again, I think we're so lulled into a sense of CGI and nothing's real anymore that perhaps we just don't appreciate the real things that are happening in movies like that. Because that was one, Tom Cruise is a stickler for doing the stunt, for taking the risk, for making it real.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would really say it's about this craftsmanship component of movie making, of actually making the movie for real, You know, and there's a real difference whether you're in a, you know, Marvel or DC or whatever production where a lot happens in front of green screen and there's one take and the actors do their thing and then it's okay, it goes off to the post-production outfit somewhere in Europe and, you know, it all gets rendered to its final result. And I think as a movie goer, you can see the difference. You can see, you know, stunts like we see in Mission Impossible as well that are made for real and then the sort of very CGI heavy world. And that really, for me, became so real when I went to attend the first day of shooting of Top Gun Maverick, which was the scene in the canyons where Tom Cruise, as the Maverick pilot, is demonstrating to the other pilots that the mission to attack
their
that timing, underground facility timing
their attack
can be flown yeah. in that timeline. And I remember Tom arriving on set at 7:30 in the morning, flying his own P-51 Mustang into China Lake. Hair and makeup, like 5 minutes max. He was in and out of the trailer, into the safety briefing with the real pilots and the real aviation safety people at the base, talking through this mission, then getting into the cockpit. And by 8 a.m., give or take, they were taking off in the Super Hornet and the Maverick livery, flying into the canyons. And then every time they would push it a little bit lower, a little bit closer to the wall, pull up a little bit later, and they'd have the chase aircraft, the Cinejets that actually filmed the outside of the aircraft, and the camera inside the cockpit filming at the same time. So the facial reactions you see in the cinema are the correct ones that are happening during the actual maneuver you're seeing on screen. So it's completely real. And they did about 30 takes, and they came back, and they just showed us the raw footage. And what impressed me more than anything else in the world of movie making is that the raw footage, minus the soundtrack, that came out of this shoot from the morning is basically what you see in the cinema. It's basically nothing done to it. Yes, there's a bit of color grading and soundtrack, but what you see in the cinema when Tom flies these insane low passes through these canyons is what they shot that morning. And I walked away from there thinking, wow, it's a different level of filmmaking. Like, this actually happened. This is not some trick box effect thing. This is what they actually did with real Navy aircraft, with real Top Gun instructor pilots, with real actor in the aircraft, in the real Star Wars canyon, in the Mojave Desert.
What brought that home to me this week was a viral audio clip that was Tom Cruise reacting to a safety breach on set of Mission Impossible. He was ropeable. And it was intense how you could feel how seriously not only he takes safety but the protection of his crew and the you should hunt this down. I don't know whether you just Google that, but it's funny. It's one thing to see the perfect maneuvers and to see the final result. I think in the tone of his voice and in the length of this clip and the dressing down that he's giving to these people that are. I suppose safety monitors or whatever they are. It was a very concerning breach. But this to me changed the way I look at Tom Cruise because sometimes you get a sense that there's a bit of a death wish or they're pushing the boundaries of safety in order to get a rush from it. Whereas I listened to this and thought there's something different going on with Tom Cruise and the way that he drives himself.
No, I think it's when you look at it's Jerry, it's Joe Kaczynski, it's the actors. There's people who are really passionate about the craft of movie making and, of course, innovating and pushing the boundaries all of the time. And yes, it has to be safe. And, you know, during COVID, how do we carry on making movies in Hollywood despite all of the restrictions? How do we keep that industry alive? And how do you keep in the age of streaming and computer gaming and mobile phone screen consumption, how do you keep that big screen long format relevant today? And I think today, you know, as Joe often says, you have to deliver an entertaining experience, an immersive experience to an audience where the audience knows they're getting the real deal. You know, they're not being, you know, fobbed off as something that can be generated on a computer. It has to be something that is unique to the big screen. And this is really where their type of filmmaking comes in. And that relentless search for realism and for the next level of capturing action on the big screen really comes to play. And you know, to witness this, both Top Gun Maverick and F1 is mind-blowing, honestly.
So let's parlay Top Gun the movie into F1, Top Gun Maverick into F1 the movie. What was the – I'm listening to this as a watch brand, and I'm thinking, how does this happen? like, you know, you've now got contact with Hans Zimmer and you've got some connections and so on. But when it comes down to the opportunity, do you just get delivered a dossier? Do you get a meeting that says, all right, here's the brief to be the watch partner of this show. We need X, Y, and Z. How does it happen from that original contact with Hans through to signing a contract that we are, they're going to be the timing partner or the sort of, however it's described, the main sponsor in the movie? And what was your emotional journey through that of just like excitement that it was going to happen and then a sense like, oh shit, this is...
No, it's going to happen.
Tell me, what's the brief and what was your response to it?
Look, I think none of these movies work the same way. There's always the different basic stakeholders of the studio and then the filmmaker, you know, the actual filmmakers behind who are mostly responsible for the artistic content between the director and the producer. And so a lot of the decisions of ultimately what is in the movie, what is on screen, are driven by artistic direction and filmmaking. So this is a lot of where the brand collaboration bit comes in, and whether it's the cars you see in Gone in 60 Seconds or, you know, Transformers or watches you see in other movies, this is really where that initial contact happens. It's between, you know, Bruckheimer Productions in that case and us. And then in the end, of course, it goes into contractual relationships with the studios and, you know, everybody behind a movie production like that. So at the end of the day, for us, whether it's you're close to the prop masters, you're close to the producers, you need that line of communication somewhere to know about the projects that are coming up, the films that are being made. And then it's a conversation that evolves from there. You know, and you can imagine this one especially, it's an Apple production. You know, it's Warner Brothers, it's Jerry Bruckheimer. So there's a lot of very heavyweight industry names behind. So all of that then is a process, of course, before you're actually on screen filming day one and you see your watches. Like case of Top Gun as well, last day before start of filming, inserting watches into the actors' pouches in the big prop trailer, and you see for the first time, okay, there's, you know, all the different characters and here's their watches, and you deliver them. And you know, it's always that moment when it becomes really real. 90 watches, I think, plus to this movie production, including all the specials and the bespoke stuff and the unique watches to the movies. And that's always the bit when you feel, oh, wow, it's a reality now.
Really simple question. Is the juice worth the squeeze with these partnerships or these big integrations? Because it seems to me like there's a lot of work on your side. Can you just answer that question as simply as possible? Because, you know, you think about Top Gun Maverick, again, is it just a case of delivering watches and then hands off, see you later? With F1 the movie, was it a case of, tell me, you know, what is the actual ask, and, you know, is it worth it? Why would you invest so much money in this partnership?
Well, I think, you know, when you make an emotional product, ultimately it is about storytelling. And it's about storytelling. You know, we've never... We haven't gone after random opportunities to be featured in movies. You know, for me, it has to make sense in a way. And being the biggest licensee of the US Navy and owning the Top Gun license in watches, it makes perfect sense to be in Top Gun. Obviously, we weren't around in 1985 in that capacity. That Top Gun license is a lot younger than that. But for Top Gun Maverick, for the reboot, which nobody knew was going to happen, it made perfect sense. Similarly, for an F1 movie, especially one that contains a big Mercedes element where the car and the team is Mercedes branded, Lewis Hamilton was a producer, it just makes sense. And it's a logical extension of our universe. And I think this is how we approach it. And it's just it's a way of storytelling that is totally complementary to your real aviation partnerships and your real racing partnerships, and just puts a different angle. And also just the ability to take thousands and thousands of your customers worldwide and put them in cinemas in front of, you know, a movie production like that, where you're a part of and you can talk about and bring talent. It's just, you know, you don't have other activation opportunities quite on that scale. And it's something that really is international, which is great.
Do you get starstruck?
Occasionally, yes. Definitely.
What was the biggest starstruck moment on F1 the movie?
On F1 the movie? I would say probably, yeah, walking into a garage with suddenly everybody present in Abu Dhabi and, you know, sort of having Brad Pitt and Damson and Jerry just right in front of you there, like in a casual let's get ready kind of conversation mode, and Joe Kaczynski was there, and you're like, you're in the middle of this and thinking, wow, it's like, you know, it does feel surreal, definitely.
And in the lead up to this, we're seeing more and more information sort of shared about the way that this movie's this movie really tries to lift the bar.
And it's shot in public, basically.
This is what audience. We need to know more about this, because I think it's called, what is it, reality inserted fiction or fiction inserted reality? I don't know, one of the two. But this is a different style of filmmaking that tries to reach that bar of realness. Yeah. And I suppose in a world where you're competing against CGI, the visceral nature of real capture has to sort of lift.
Yeah.
You know, you have to give an almost a POV type experience. But tell me about the ways that this movie will be remembered as a piece of filmmaking, because it's tried to do some pretty ambitious things.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, many movies are shot in complete secrecy, and the only information that's out there is the information that the studio or the producers release at any given moment in time. Now, because of the nature of F1 and because it's inserted into reality, it had to happen at actual Grand Prix races over two seasons, or three seasons in total. So there is no way of hiding anything. Most of the things that are being shot in front of a sports live audience. They had to be. Right, so everything was out in the public, not only like the fact that this is happening and who's in it and, you know, bits of the storyline, but also the fact that often this gave the production a very, very extreme time window, right? You had the grid, it was, you know, between qualifying or just at the end of qualifying, and they had like 7-8 minutes to capture a scene before the actual racing moved on, right? So you can't retake, you can't say, oh, we need another half hour here, guys. Sorry, can you delay the start of the Porsche Cup? You know, it's not going to work. And this is something that's never been done like this before. And you think about Top Gun was filmed in sort of, you know, the US Navy world, completely confidential, completely, there's almost no leaked photographs from set at all. Whereas F1, the movie, from the first day of shooting, was basically out in public. And that has its very own challenges, because then people are obviously getting very interested, what's happening, how is it all puzzling, how the pieces fit together. And I think this was a challenge that nobody ever had to navigate before. It's like doing theater. It's like live performance in a way. You know, and you're showing a lot of your production to everybody all of the time.
The adrenaline the actors must have had to think, not only do I have to hit my mark, but I don't get a second take.
Yeah. And I've got 20,000 people watching me doing my job.
Now, tell me about the process or the skill sort of upgrades that the drivers, the actors had to, like, what did they do to get to a point where they could drive at speed, and how fast were they driving? What was the, you know, because I guess I'm thinking about a movie like, what was it, the James Hunt movie with Chris Hemsworth. Mm. I even remember that the crowds were definitely fake. Mm. You could see that they were sort of CGI crowds. Mm. And there was just a touch of, you could definitely tell that there was a lot of movie magic going on. Mm. But how real were the driving scenes, and how fast were they going?
Yeah, so without knowing the precise ins and outs, what basically happened is that they had a 3-month build-up training, you know, starting in slower cars, into F3 cars, and then ultimately into F2 cars, which the Formula One car, Apex GP, is a modified F2 car. So it's an F2 chassis that has an F1 body kit on that makes it look identical to an F1 car, but it's a little bit slower and a little bit easier to drive, sounds better as well than an F1 car, incidentally. And it really was that workup of Damson and Brad working their way up different levels of driving skill until they were at the point where the scenes they needed to drive and deliver, they could actually do comfortably and safely, as we said, even though Lewis was pushing him a bit to go and spin out. But yeah, no, and that's obviously been absolutely unique, you know, in single-seater racing. I don't think that's ever been done before on a movie screen.
Chris, we have some watches in front of us. What role did these ones play in the movie? Were they in the actual movie? You've kept this very mysterious, but one of them looks quite worn as I pick up a Big Pilot perpetual calendar. It looks that the leather is definitely been on a certain hole position. So it looks
give you
properly
three guesses.
Worn.
Yeah, so this is a screen-worn movie boss watch worn by Javier Bardem, who plays the Apex GP team principal. This is a unreleased Big Pilot perpetual calendar stainless steel black dial, which doesn't actually exist in our lineup. That hasn't existed like that in our lineup. And this was a dial color combination that we, you know, defined together with the filmmakers, really to suit team colors and Javier's character, you know, big personality, big watch, big pilot, big boss. Also, of course, inspired by the fact that Toto wears quite a bit of Big Pilot related watches. And this is the one that's screen worn by Javier, and you see him in the trailer already quite a bit, and later on in the movie as well.
Is Javier a watch guy?
I do not know. I have no idea.
As far as the movie's concerned, yes, he was. Yes. And what else do we have?
Yeah, then the one on your wrist, obviously, this is literally the performance chronograph in 5N Gold in team colors gold and black, worn by Damson Idris. So this is not the screen-worn watch, but this is the model that we developed basically for the movie and for his role in the movie, and that's been worn by him throughout. And then we have the two stainless steel team watches here, which are really the watches that appear on the team's wrist, on the mechanic's wrist, and that are available to buy for everyone in stores right now.
Now, we have a hell of a story coming up about Brad Pitt and his Ingenieur. And I'm going to seed you, dear listener, with one more big cliffhanger. Is Chris Granger Air in the movie? We'll answer that question on the next episode.
Well, we just... Thank you.